listening to the Hometown Losers, the St. Louis Sports Podcast, with Josh, Adam, and OJ.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back here to the Hometown Losers Podcast. I'm joined, as always, with my cohorts here, and Adam and OJ. How are we doing today, gentlemen?
Doing great here. Thanks for asking.
I'm good.
Glad
I'm
to good. Hear that. You're doing great. I'm glad to hear that, guys. Well, we are actually joined by a fourth member here and a guest star in Danny. Danny, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today, bud?
I am doing amazing. Thanks for having me in, guys.
Woo! Glad to have you here.
Yeah, what's up?
Yeah. Glad to have Very our glad first to guest. Have here.
Yeah, exactly.
19, and we finally get a guest. This is exciting.
Right. Somebody actually finally agreed to come on.
You're very loosely using star, but I'm here.
Yeah. Well, there we go. Jordy Bennington won't return my phone call, so we, you know, give it just
second best.
Fine. Yeah. We did bump Matt Damon for you. I'm gonna do the Jimmy Kimmel thing. We did bump Matt Damon for you, so
he'll be on next time.
Right. Anyways. But anyways, for our listeners here, Danny is our resident soccer expert. Danny, why don't you talk a little bit to our listeners here, kind of like some of your credentials, your experience of soccer and like kind of your expertise around it.
Well, I played in high school and also played in college and was lucky enough to be a loser of a national championship at the junior college level, which was a great accomplishment to lose multiple championships. It's always fun. Always the bridesmaid. I, after that, had multiple injuries, so I moved out of the country and went to Honduras, where they're not going to make me pass physical. I played in the Honduran. What's up?
No, I was just laughing. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I played in the Honduran league for about 2 years, where it was more than anything just a gimmick of take the white guy one on one and see if you could beat him. And I mean, I loved it. It was a whole country of people passionate about the sport. So it
sounds like a pretty cool experience.
Yeah.
And sure. I was down there when the U.S. qualified for the 2010 World Cup. And
wow,
I was there. Honduras also qualified for that one on the Jonathan Bornstein goal. And
I remember that goal. Yeah.
Got to see a country in pure pandemonium and got ripped out of a taxi and paraded on people's shoulders as if I had just scored the goal, and just amazing experience.
Sounds awesome. That's
awesome. It does sound awesome. I have nothing like, especially when it comes to something like on the national level like that, I don't have any experience yeah. with. I've won some championships and stuff like that, but not like that. That sounds pretty epic.
I've lost championships, but
right, but at a high level.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Higher level than me, that's for sure. But the reason why I wanted to bring you on, Danny, is because, we've known each other for quite a while. And obviously, I know that you know the game of soccer better than us three knuckleheads. So I wanted to be able to give our listeners a chance to kind of like learn a little bit on just pick the brain of a guy that's been playing at a high level for soccer and stuff like that, or has played, not is playing, unfortunately. Sorry to crush your dreams there. So we're just going to do kind of a round.
I believe the last 60 pounds crushed those dreams, bud.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've all been in that boat before. That's for sure. Yeah. So we're going to do a round table, kind of questionnaire, if you're cool with that. And we'll kind of go from there. Adam, if you want to kick us off here, you have a
Absolutely.
Question for Danny?
Yeah. So thanks, Danny, for coming out to, joining our podcast this week. We're all really excited that you're here. I just wanted to first ask you, though, about St. Louis City SC. Obviously, we've had a really exciting, start so far. We're seeing a lot of great things. But in terms of competing with other teams in the MLS, how do you think that the team will overcome any challenges we might see, further on down the road? Obviously we lost a game, but, do you see any of these challenges coming up? And especially as we get further into our schedule, we're going to be facing tougher teams.
Well, there's definitely going to be some big challenges coming their way. But as you said, what you've seen from this team so far is, it's been breathtaking. It's been amazing. They have a unique style of play that is going to win them games by itself. And you're going to hear, you've been hearing it referred to as lucky. They've gotten lucky. They've gotten lots of, you know, gift passes. You create those opportunities by, you know, being annoying, being pest, and that's a big part of this playing style.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm seeing.
Go for it.
I just was going to say, yeah, we obviously see, you know, the our team is, you know, it's rather physical. We're seeing a lot of fouls and whatnot. Obviously, you know, that's some of our playing style for sure, and we're definitely a more physical team, which is exciting to see for sure. I was going to say overall, any of those challenges that you see besides being lucky, obviously right now, do you actually see anything that worries you up to this point?
It's so not necessarily with the way the roster is at the moment. I mean, depth wise, it's a first year team. So you have other teams that have built their depth up over the last 4 or 5 seasons, and obviously this team couldn't do that. One of the biggest issues is with their playing style. It's just they're masters of chaos. That's what they're trying to produce on the field, is just absolute chaos. And it's like the little like jitterbugs on the water, just anything hits the water and they scatter. They're trying to just be on you at all times. And what happens with teams that play that way is when it's cold, you're able to play really well. Cause I mean, you can put in all the miles on the field that's required to play that style. But as the weather gets hotter, that's where that it's a much more like tasking style of play. And that's when injuries start to pop up and that kind of stuff.
Makes sense.
But that playing style is also going to be one of the biggest advantages this team's going to have going forward, is they just have such a well established and like well put together playing style that it's going to be like a plug and play sort of process where they can handpick the guys and, you know, toss them into this. And we're going to be relying on a lot of guys that are like maximum effort, as opposed to someone like Lionel Messi would never fit into this team. Well, I would love to see him on any team.
Well, I think we all would, yeah.
Yeah, we're dreaming, right? Just but can't sure. Do that. Sure.
I do like the style. It's good to see a team that works hard. You know, just because it's you know, nowadays a lot of pro athletes kind of have like a professional vibe, you know, where, like you're saying, they might conserve themselves, you know, to be better late in the season. And it kind of gets away from, you know, the schoolyard feel to it, which I think St. Louis kind of brings, where people are just playing as hard as they can to try and win that game, you know.
Yeah, but absolutely. There's like a hard hat mentality to the way they play.
Yeah, and it's endearing. Like, I really think it's going to help the team be more successful in the city, too. So.
And I'm glad you said endearing, because at some point they're going to lose a couple games and they're going to need people to still have that endearing thought of.
Oh, absolutely.
Turning against them.
Absolutely. And, you know, kind of going off of that a little bit, that last game against Minnesota, they lost 1-0. And Minnesota, you know, they kind of just hung back and waited for them to bring the ball in deep. And then they just tried to counterattack. And I consider that to be kind of a cowardly style of play, honestly. I'm sure there's plenty of teams that do it, though. But my point was, talk about that, too. But the specific question I was going to ask was, do you think that that style is like an Achilles heel to St. Louis?
So, I mean, to have such a well thought out playing style, I mean, Inter Miami's been in the league for 4 years and they still don't know what they're doing. Like, every year they're chasing the next Messi, Luis Suarez. They want a name, but they just cannot play together. So it's the playing style will absolutely win them games on its own. But I mean, one of the other challenges that's going to this team is going to face is it's the same thing that the Cardinals and Blues and I mean the Rams had always had. You're not a destination. You're not going to get like the biggest free agents or the biggest players because it's middle of the United States. Any European right. player has no idea what St. Louis is.
Exactly. It's
so
true.
I do think the playing style will be a very big benefit for making it so this team can grow. And then you might see the playing style kind of morph into something that's more accommodating to some of the star players a little bit later on down the line. But yeah, as of right now, it's everyone out there has to have their hard hat when they come to work, as opposed to we got two guys that just need to have their shiny shoes on. That's how I was. I was the shiny shoe guy.
Oh, okay. I see. So you didn't have to do very much work. You just go hang out near the box and wait for them to pass you the ball.
Well, yeah. I mean, until I started getting injuries and then I became the bowling ball. So yeah.
So you were Zava is what you're saying. Zava from Ted Lasso, right? I gotcha. If anybody's actually seen that episode yet, I shouldn't have said that. My bad.
Uh-oh, spoiler alert.
Wow, spoilers. Jesus.
My bad. I am sorry. 4 weeks, but all right. Anyways. And that's a very interesting, analysis on, you know, how the injuries are going to be able to, like, potentially rack up during when it gets hotter and stuff like that. OG, I know you actually made a comment about that actually last session. About, you know, can we keep this up? Can they continue to do it, especially when things get hotter? You know, your endurance is going to go down because obviously you're going to be sweating a lot more. You could, you know, have that potential of overheating and stuff like that as well. OJ, do you have another question that you wanted to be asked, Danny?
Actually, yeah, because it does still relate to that a little bit. Do you know, I assume you probably watch the European leagues pretty well too. And I was wanting to know if any of those teams play this kind of style, because I'm basically trying to get it, you know, I'm trying to think about how viable it is over the long term, you know, kind of to that point. Like, I figured if a big club actually uses this style, then maybe it is viable long term in the right circumstances. So that's kind of what I was going to ask.
That's a really good question. And there are quite a few teams that are playing that style. So the Gegenpress is one that was kind of like Ralf Rangnick's, you know, child. And Ralf Rangnick is most well known now for playing a big role in destroying Manchester United last season. That was where he gained fame nationally, it seems. Coach Carnell is coming over from New York Red Bulls. So
yeah.
Red Bulls play, they'll call it energy drink style soccer, which is just the old commercials for Red Bull of like, you'll get wings or whatever that was. That's like their playing style. It's everyone drinks a Red Bull and just go out on the field and just like run around screaming, chasing the ball, basically.
Right.
That's like the mindset you get when you watch them play, but it is so incredibly effective. And there's a lot more to it than just run around like a madman. But yeah. Red Bull has established this as like a playing style throughout all their teams. So like RB Leipzig right. in Germany plays that same way, and Salzburg, where Brendan Aaronson was coming from, he was also playing that style. So Jesse Marsh, the American coach that was at Leeds that just got fired about 2.5 months ago, like the day after the transfer window, which I still have no idea why they let him have a transfer window if they're going to get rid of him.
Right.
He was another guy that came from Leipzig, came from just all throughout the Red Bull family, and that was the way he was playing. So Leeds is another team that, even though he's gone, they've created that team with that same kind of style of play. So until a new manager is able to kind of bring his own guys in and move guys out, they also kind of play that style of a lot of counterattack and fun to watch, but just results just quite aren't there, which is why Marsh is gone and why they're they're a few points safe out of relegation. But so there's quite a few teams that play that way. But I would think the best examples would be Salzburg has done a pretty good job in the Champions League. They've given some of the bigger teams a run for their money, but they're just outmanned. And then every season they're going to lose about 5 or 6 players and they bring in new guys. And you're going to see the same thing with St. Louis. Unfortunately, I think St. Louis is a town that falls in love with their players, and you're already seeing it happen with a lot of these guys. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot of year to year, a lot of changeover, and that'll be a bit of a shock for a lot of fans that fall in love with some of these players. But Salzburg would be the big one. And then obviously Leipzig, that I believe are in third place in Germany right now and, you know, have been competing for the top the last couple of years, but it's Bayern's to hold. So they're competing for second, basically.
Gotcha.
It's actually interesting you're talking about turnover and stuff like that, because that's actually one of the questions that somewhat around the question that I had for you. We actually, a long time ago, Danny, you and I had a discussion about the loans and loaning process and stuff like that. So there might be some listeners that don't understand what loans are in soccer, and like especially on the international stage and stuff like that. Could you explain, or just kind of, I guess, summarize what like loaning is and like kind of how it works? Because I do believe we have 1 or 2 players that are on loan currently that are in the St. Louis system, St. Louis City system. I could be wrong on that, right? Or we might be loaning from them, loaning from a different team. But could you kind of explain to the listeners what that kind of is?
Yes. So there are different reasons that you would want to loan a player. The greatest example that I'll go through is Chelsea. So they're a very unique aspect of soccer, and one of the things that makes it so unique is you can loan players out to get them valuable experience. We see that now with Chelsea. They purchased Malo Gusto from Olympique Lyon in France, and then he was one of their like 40 million signings this last transfer window, one of like the 90 people they signed, it seems.
Right.
They purchased him and immediately said, now you keep playing where you're at. You're developing well, so you stay there. We also saw the same thing with Christian Pulisic. When he was first purchased by Chelsea, they bought him, but they also knew that they were about to be banned from, you know, signing any players for what was supposed to be 2 years and then wound up being just the 1 year. They purchased him and kept him in Dortmund rather than bringing him over, because he was getting some playing time, but not, they just knew bringing him over was going to be in, he'd have to adapt first. You have guys with Chelsea. The biggest U.S. prospect in goal, Gabriel Slonina, just signed from Chicago Fire and then was loaned right back to Chicago, but he's now over with Chelsea after being on loan for a little bit. I would bet next season he's loaned out to a team. But it's so you can get guys valuable experience in game time, because those big teams, they don't have a lot of minutes for an 18, 19, 20-year-old unless it's someone like Pedri or Gavi with Barcelona that,
right,
you know, the second that kid puts his shoes on, he's the best player, no matter whether he's playing with kids or men. It's just, there's teams like that they'll have lots of players that they'll call wonder kids, but they just, you know, yeah, we got this striker that might be really good, but we can also just spend $60-70 million and, you know, bring someone in for a year,
right, that we know is good right now.
Yes. And it goes down to money, but you'll see loans are, it's not just the big teams, you'll see it in second division, third division, and like everyone's been following Wrexham now. Wrexham's got about 5 guys on loan that are loaned from teams that are a division or two above them, because like I said, if you're in the third division in England, you're also going to have players that you're trying to develop, but you might not be able to promise one of your 19-year-old kids that, you know, we can play you right now, because if you're trying to move up a division as well, he might be better served going to a lesser team in the same division or a division below you. So you benefit from loaning players out. One of the other reasons that you'll loan them out is, as you see with Chelsea, and what is often kind of jokingly called the loan army of Chelsea, where you could field an entire team and a bench. Chelsea at the last winter transfer window had 20 players on loan, some of those being prospects, but also guys like Romelu Lukaku. Lukaku's still a Chelsea guy. They spent over 120 million on him, had him for a season, and they're like, yeah, never mind. We're done with you, and sent him to Inter Milan. And then if you look at Chelsea play, you're sitting there going, God, this team needs a striker.
Yeah.
Right.
If only we had one that we paid 120 million for. When I was trying to think about the loans a little bit, the one guy that I looked into and I just couldn't believe he's still there. Timoue Bakayoko is a Chelsea midfielder that was signed in 2017 from Monaco. The last time he played for Chelsea was in 2018. He has played in the Champions League for Napoli, Milan, and Monaco over the last few years. The guy hasn't been with Chelsea for 5 years, but these big teams pay these players so much money that when they try to move players, they can't. They're stuck with them. So they'll loan them out and say, you pay half of his contract, or you pay some of his yearly wages. And Chelsea just signed all those players for 8 years. They're going to run into huge problems because no one can take them. They're going to have to loan all the players out if they don't all hit. And you're seeing it with Mudryk right now. He's been struggling, and they're not going to give him time because they're going to find another player. They'll say, hey, we got another player that's going to cost us $100 million, and he's ready.
That's crazy. How does the loan work? Like, if Chelsea wants him back, can they just be like, hey, we want him back now, and they have to give him back, or do they have to wait till the end of the season, or what?
So, like, with Lukaku, you mean?
No, I think what he means is, like, the just in general, the transfer. So if a guy, like, if a team like Chelsea or whatever, any team, wants a player back from loan, how does that work?
So there are different ways they'll handle it. It all depends what your reason for loaning a player out. If it's developmental, they will have in the contract that they can bring the player back. So, for example, if Chelsea loans out an 18-year-old central midfielder that they think is going to develop, and he's playing in the championship for a team that is not using him, they're going to call him back because he'll develop better playing with their team, just, you know, practicing with them and then getting youth games with them, as opposed to sitting on a team that doesn't have the same facilities bench. The opposite will happen where, you know, you look at Romelu Lukaku. He's been hurt a lot of the year. Inter Milan has, I think he's got like 6 goals for him all season in 21, 22 games. He's not playing. So if you're Inter, you're trying to purchase him long-term at the beginning of the year, but now you're probably looking at it like, did we really want him? Did we get the best of him 3 years ago? So part of his deal was, I think Inter paid like $9 million to bring him over for the year, and they're paying his salary. So you'll pay not a transfer fee, but a loan fee that ends at the end of the year. You'll also see some deals where they'll attach on to the loan a purchase option or different things. If he plays 20 games, you have to sign him. Or if your team gets promoted, you have to sign him. Like, and there will be an agreed price already set in there. So it all depends what you want. If you're trying to develop a guy, you're not going to let him go somewhere and sit on their bench.
I got you. That's cool. So, yeah, it's like unique contracts depending on the situations. All right, cool.
Yeah, so if you're trying to, like, cut salary, you're saying, hey, I don't care if you don't use the guy. He's not coming back.
Right. He's yours now.
Yeah, like if the United States could have had something like that for Christian Pulisic during his time at Chelsea here, they would have been saying, hey, we need to bring him back and move him someplace else. But that's not, it's not their property.
Right.
Hey,
well, cool, so, man.
Yeah, thanks for explaining that. That really helps. I've always, you know, been curious about that, is how that loan, you know, process worked out. So that was very good in-depth answer that I think all of our listeners will appreciate. So getting back to St. Louis City SC, though, I wanted to get your input on how you think that City SC will have, you know, as a whole on the MLS. You know, how do you see the MLS league actually evolving in the years to come, especially with now that we're a part of it?
That is a very, very good question. And I think we are going to see the biggest answer that comes out of how it's going to evolve very soon. As far as Sint Stadium, that when you've had players that have come over from the Bundesliga, they've said this stadium is as good, if not better, than places we've played all around Europe.
That's a huge compliment.
Yeah.
I heard that from Joe Keeney. Joe Keeney said that too on a podcast. He said the facilities are great. Yeah.
I definitely think the ownership certainly did a great job with obviously recruiting, you know, MLS team for St. Louis and obviously getting the fan base going here as well. We've obviously been waiting for a while, and the anticipation was certainly there. And I'm glad to see, you know, it went off without a hitch, so to speak, and everyone's really enjoying it. So not only the fans, but also the players. So you think we're going to.
First off, that stadium, is going to give them an advantage, full stop, because it's awesome. It is going to be, while St. Louis may not be a destination, that stadium for players in the MLS, that could become one where they say they will have all the facilities. I can, you know, we're not practicing 40 miles away.
Yeah, isn't that unique for us in the sense of that we're literally have all of our facilities literally centrally located? Isn't that rather unique from an MLS perspective?
It's unique for, like, world soccer perspective, to be honest. Like, even in Real Madrid, they have facilities that are, you know, quite a distance away where they've been playing the last two seasons while they're doing all the work. So it's a very unique situation. And the fact that they were able to do it downtown, I mean, let's be honest, Major League Soccer has wanted a team in St. Louis since Brian McBride was the number one pick in their first season. The problem is every opportunity there was, because downtown just kind of seemed dead.
Yeah.
Every opportunity to put a stadium was either over in like Collinsville or out in Fenton, and they just wanted something downtown, and it wasn't happening.
Next to the Arch. Yeah.
Yeah.
It took the Kendall Taylor family to come in and say, we can move things around the city. Like, we got it. And it's, I mean,
and it's very interesting, because that was actually one of my other questions. And I just wanted to, since we're already discussing that, how does that ownership group actually differ from the other MLS teams? You know, I know obviously they have a lot of the ownership has ties back to the Enterprise group, because I think the president or founder of Enterprise, that his daughter, actually, Carolyn, she actually owns and was the president of City SC, from my understanding. And I think this is also the first MLS team that was, you know, predominantly female, you know, owned and ran as well. So it certainly is getting we have a different ownership group, per se, from what we're used to seeing across other cities. Do you think that, you know, with that in mind, are we a little different, and this is a good thing?
Yeah, I think it's a great thing. By starting from the point of view of this entire ownership group is female led, they're already starting things differently, which I believe leads into the way they were building the team, where you sign players and you can bring some of the guys over, 6-7 months in advance of their first game, which is such a unique opportunity that you don't ever see in sports.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the biggest things of this ownership group that especially applies to St. Louis is there is zero chance that St. Louis is going to get burned again like you did with the Rams or the football Cardinals.
For sure. Yeah. Right. This ownership group is they're vested in St. Louis. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Carolyn Kendall is obviously, you know, born, raised here. Her father, obviously born and raised here and founded Enterprise, which is, you know, one of the largest corporations, you know, in St. Louis, and obviously, you know, has you know, the name of another well-known arena right down the street. So,
mm-hmm.
So yes, yeah, that's great and to see.
And also, too, the fact that we have such a big partner in Purina as well, I think that does definitely goes a very long way, too, on being able to support the team, you know, and to the ownership side of things, right? I mean, it felt to me as if we got another Tom Stillman. Because people tend to forget that during the dark ages for the Blues, before Tom Stillman and his group took over the Blues, there was a lot of talks that St. Louis Blues were going to be, you know, going somewhere else, that they were going to be moving cities. Because again, to your point, Danny, as you said, St. Louis was not a, you know, a destination location. It didn't matter if the players loved the city. Clearly, Gretzky, you know, literally has, and my dog's looking at me, sorry, Wayne Gretzky, he still has a house here in St. Louis. He met his wife in St. Louis, you know, so like it goes a long way. But as you said, it's not a destination, right? So having an ownership group that's from here and understands, hey, this is what we can do in St. Louis, let us show you what St. Louis can do. I think it speaks volumes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You know, ironically, I guess you'd say, tell me if I'm wrong, but during that whole Saskatoon thing with the Blues, was that not Ralston Purina that owned it and wanted to sell it? Because isn't that why the whole draft didn't – we didn't even show up for one of those drafts? Because they wouldn't let them sell the team to Saskatoon. And so they're like, well, screw it. We're just not going to run the team anyway.
I was going
to
say Purina actually – well, Purina actually technically did – yeah, they owned the Blues way back in the day, yeah.
Yeah.
Because obviously they played in the Checker Dome, which was Purina Checker Dome. And of course – but anyway, yeah.
You had to bring them up, man.
My bad.
But obviously,
maybe they will be leaving.
Well, Purina is obviously just a sponsor. They are not the owners. So, and obviously, as you can see, based upon the ownership and also back to the venue as well, if you've, it's world renowned, the fact that this venue, the food and the, like, the vibes of the whole place are very St. Louis centric, you know, like,
they're not there.
Yeah, toasted raviolis, I was going to say. They're really vibing with the city, and, you know, you really feel like this is part of our community, is very much so, and it just, it feels right, you know what I mean? So.
Mm-hmm.
And soccer more than a lot of other sports has a community style atmosphere. Going to any professional sports game is enjoyable, but there is something different about soccer. It's more, you're going to a game that might be 0-0 and you're going to be on your feet the whole time.
It's pretty crazy to think.
It's not a power play. Shoot it.
And part of it is because a lot of that traditionally comes from Europe, where those teams represent their cities. Like, they're not just, like, they don't move, you know what I mean? Like, you know, West Ham's team is West Ham's team. Like, they're not going somewhere else because they're not selling tickets or some shit. You know what I mean? Like, there's even more civic pride in the team because of that, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's when you get these awesome chants, too, that the entire crowd is part of. And, like, it's a tradition now at the Blues games is Sweet Caroline. It played at the – or not – I'm not Sweet Caroline. Country Road playing in the third period. That all started during the playoffs, you know, game 7 against Dallas in the 2019 Stanley Cup run. That all happened because they're like, well, the crowd's getting a little anxious, let's bring them together. And you see it in international soccer that you have these, you know, thousands and thousands of people chanting the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it does have a huge effect on the players. You know, they hear it and they know that, they, you know, it can get them going, and the opposition can hear it too. and, you know, kind of rattles them. And I don't know if you guys know, Danny, you might know, but when the international Icelandic team, when they play their home games and they have like a thunderclap, like the and clap, and like imagine though, like being the opposition, the opposite nation coming out of that tunnel and hearing that, that's got to be nerve-wracking, even though it's not that many people comparatively. Like that's got to be really cool to have the Icelandic, you know, you feel the proud. It's kind of like the haka, you know, for New Zealand and, and rugby, and so to speak.
It's funny you mentioned the haka, because all I had in my mind is our Blues power play dance. I'm like, oh boy.
Oh yeah.
It's like the opposite of a haka.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of intimidating.
Exactly. OJ, do you have another question for Danny?
Oh, let me see. Yeah, I definitely did. So let's see. Kind of already answered one of them. I was going to say, I was going to ask you, is there some significance of the number 10 for a player? Like, because I keep hearing on some people that are discussing it, they discuss how Leuven, you gave Leuven the number 10 and all that. It's like, so is that more of a something that is by position than just a number you would get randomly, you know? Like,
so that's a good question, and it's kind of changed over the last handful of years, where you'll see teams that will say, we want players to, if you're a starter, you're going to, like the U.S. did that the last, in some of the friendlies recently, if you're starting, you're going to get one of the low numbers.
Right. I mean, that makes
number sense. Number 10 specifically is because that was Diego Maradona. That was Pele. That was Luis Figo. It is the number that, like,
it's like giving somebody 99 in hockey.
It's a number that, like, people that in their countries have churches devoted to them. Like, I mean, there is a church of Diego Maradona. Like, he had even signed some things that would say Dios, which is God in Spanish, but with the I and the O is the number 10. Like, it was a thing. I mean,
that's awesome.
So numbers are, it signifies a lot of things in a lot of sports, but with soccer, there's just certain numbers that they don't retire. They just keep like gaining more fame.
Like, you're part of the legacy.
Like in hockey, if they gave every player that they're like, this guy's a star, Connor McDavid would have 99 right now. You would see the best player on the best player with 99. And then, you know, you got kids playing hockey when they're young and they're like, God, I want to get good enough to wear 99. But in the pros, you have a handful of numbers that are like, yeah, we don't do those.
Yeah. That's a lot of pressure for sure.
But I was just going to say, sorry. I think part of the reason for like the difference in the number around like the world of soccer is, like, obviously number 99, they don't care about that in Russia or Sweden. Those numbers aren't retired there. But soccer is such a global game that the numbers are just world famous. And then in the United States, we have the biggest league for hockey. We have the biggest league for basketball and baseball, which is why numbers get retired here. And you don't see, you don't see numbers keep getting repeated because they're just become so famous for one player. But you have all of the greatest, all the greatest attacking players have had number 10 or 9, it seems, at some point. The best, best midfielders, if they're creative midfielders, are usually going to be number 7. And
seven, yeah.
Your defenders are like a 4 and a 5. And what's interesting about it is it's at some point rooted in the position on the field. Like, Edward Leuven plays as a number 6. That's the defensive midfielder. Like, they have almost like looking at a baseball team where, one's the pitcher, 2's the catcher. they have that same sort of like number system in soccer. And then in international teams, you'll see some teams will do that. Where goalie will be one, you know, they'll start with their backs at 2, 3, 4, 5 and then work their way up. So 10 always meant you were the creative force, and your 11 is like your hold up striker, your guy who's playing like Klaus. And then that 10 was the guy who sat underneath him with no defensive responsibility, who could just create magic. So yeah, the number 10 is in soccer. It is such a special thing just because it's like hallowed ground. You're like, oh my God, think of all the people that have worn this. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to look back and remember playing on terrible club teams and like the fight for numbers and, you know, I went number 10 and she's like, it means nothing at that point. But, you know, as you grow up, it's just like that number is everything to you. And you'll see it in other sports where guys will sell the jersey number. I don't know in my history of following soccer, other than maybe with Zlatan, there's ever been a guy who has purchased the number or had to make a deal to get the number, because there will be guys when they'll go from one team to the other that if they have a guy who has that number, the team will usually sell that player. Like they'll send one guy out to bring the other one in.
Yeah. Because
that's crazy.
Oh my God.
Especially in a 9, like 10, baseball
where, you know,
position.
Yeah. I'm used to baseball where, yeah, you know,
especially
like,
when
okay,
you're
we'll switch
paying
it up.
The guy like,
yeah,
you
exactly.
already paid the guy like right, $120 million or
yeah,
some shit.
Like, all right, you get
well,
to get
we
the number.
We'll
change
this
other dude.
Got the same numbers.
Can you imagine?
Yeah,
wow.
But if you change numbers and you have one of those big numbers, it's like a demotion.
It's a big deal.
It's an insult.
Yeah.
No, it's like literally like a title or whatever, you know.
No,
and usually that player's taking your position too. They're not going to say, "Hey, we have a goalie."
Well, I was just about to say, yeah,
that makes sense.
And they're not going to
exactly when you
bench.
Right. When you're going out and getting a top end player, like a number 10, typically you're replacing your 10 on the team. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yep. And Danny, actually to that point, you know, as you said, you don't really see it as much anymore. I mean, obviously the number 10 is still sacred ground. So is the number 9, number 7, specifically those three numbers. But I really believe that has changed a little bit with the younger generations, not because they want to make the the 10 doesn't mean anything anymore. But I think Cristiano Ronaldo has kind of changed that when he rejected the 10 and to wear 7, even though he is a striker, you know what I mean, in the forward position. I think that really changed a generation's ideas of what numbers could be in that holy ground, so to speak.
But I believe a lot of that was marketing, because there was another Ronaldo that already wore number 10.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I forgot all about that. Cause when they played both for Real Madrid, it was Ronaldo and Cristiano Ronaldo. That's correct. Different spelling, of course, but yeah.
Dude, yeah. So Ronaldo. there was already a true Ronaldo at 10. So that would have been problematic.
Well, so as far as that goes, then how do you think Leuven has fulfilled that role?
Well, he's not your typical number 10. He's not that like out and out all offense. He's actually a really, really talented holding midfielder, which this team is going to need because it's so much counterattacking that you need that guy that can like fill the gaps between your center backs and your midfield and then progress the ball forward. He's been a lot of fun to watch because he's a guy that when he was playing in Germany was thought of as like a wonder kid when he was first coming up. They thought this guy's going to be a star, but at 17 years old, he could be a star in the midfield or on the back line. So that's kind of where that defensive midfielder comes from, is he's a guy that can do a little bit of both, usually is more athletically gifted or, you know, can run more than a lot of the center backs, but, you know, isn't the guy that like a Messi, someone like that, that you'll see Messi will just do something magical. But I mean, if Messi loses the ball, that ball's not coming back to Messi unless someone else gets it back. Like that's not his job.
Like,
Yeah. That's not his job.
It's true, though.
I just love the dichotomy. Heaven forbid Lionel Messi go get his own soccer ball.
Well, I mean, we saw it in the World Cup with Kylian Mbappe. Mbappe carried France on his shoulders, but there were multiple games where you would see him just walking back like, nah, I'm saving my energy for offense because he knows he can outrun everybody. But what's the point in running back on defense? There's other guys on the team for that. And that's why it's so difficult to build a team around a star, because you just have so many players that you bring a guy in because, oh, you're good at going forward, but now you're going to play on a team where you're not allowed to go forward. I mean, that's why PSG is destined to fail. You can't have three guys who are all in the top five or six players in the world, but there's still only one ball. Like, at some point, someone's got to play defense. And I mean, it doesn't matter who they have in that midfield. They're always going to be overrun, and they can't do anything. They can pile up wins off of bad teams, but you have three players on offense that all can create by themselves. But you know, if that ball is taken away from one of them, all three of them are just going to sit there and be like, the midfield better get that ball back.
Yeah, because essentially,
they're all hands length away.
When it's a turnover, too, it essentially becomes a 10 versus 7, because those three are not, obviously, as you said, going to be pushing. I mean, obviously, they'll press if, you know, a defender's got the ball, you know, at the, you know, the midfield line or something like that. But they're not really going out there trying to, like, tackle and get the ball back.
And that's what St. Louis City, the biggest thing that they're going to be trying to do is when they create some of these turnovers, the entire team is going to be attacking. It's going to be like the 10 man pushing up on offense, trying to create something in the blink of an eye. And we've already seen it through some of the first couple of games where goals that we've given up have been by some of these teams that have like verifiable stars, like Enzo Capetti with Charlotte. He gave them headaches, but he's another one. He loses that ball, it's not his job. Like, his job is to, when we get the ball back, he is going to torment City defenders. Or Sebastian Giroussi, we saw him just score like a magnificent goal, that ball over the top that he brought down, like, where he got that touch, I don't know. That's only an Argentinian, it seems. But we don't have that guy who's going to bring that elite skill level. But we also don't have a guy who's not going to do his part for the rest of the team. And that's something that's really unique to about three or four teams in Major League Soccer. And it's very unexpected that a team in their first year of all new players coming together has found a way to establish that.
And Danny, to go on, OJ, sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that's like, it's pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah. Danny, you know, do you think that some of the success that, you know, STLSC has been having is because that they played a little bit together last year with City 2 and stuff like that? Obviously, some of the, you know, names have changed, roster changed, but it seems like they've gotten a lot of training together. You know what I mean? And obviously kind of know each other's roles, kind of know like how to play, but you can just feel the spirit of this team is all for one, one for all kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, a little bit. But I think the biggest thing that they gained by bringing over players so early was they were able to bring their families, whether it's, you know, when they're not already playing games and traveling, they were able to bring them over, find the schools, you know, find restaurants, go to the zoo, go see the arch, go do that stuff when they don't have all of these other commitments that are pulling them away from the family. And you're not, you know, traveling to Seattle on a Saturday. And then as when we get to summer, they're going to be playing on some Wednesdays. You're not in Seattle on a Saturday. And then on Wednesday over in New York. And then your wife is trying to figure out how to buy a house in a new country. They were able to do all that stuff to get situated when things were calmer. And there's only a handful of people that had any idea who Roman, like Roman Berkey was, or, you know, some of the bigger guys that they brought in. Now everyone in St. Louis knows them, but at the time they could walk around and, you know, be sitting in front of you at Schnucks and you'd never know who it was. It gave them a chance to like get their feet wet in their new home and, you know, try to get situated and get everything in order. So some of them were here playing, but I do think just not having to uproot your family mid-season or like at the start of the season, I think that played a big role, because the guys that you're seeing having the biggest impact right away are the ones that were just kind of here hanging out. And as a soccer fan, I was looking at it like, this is a terrible approach. I thought they needed to loan those guys somewhere to get it.
Really?
Take it off 7 months seems dangerous. What?
Oh, sorry. You cut off there for a little bit. I thought you weren't talking, so I asked another. I asked which guys.
Well, like especially Roman Berkey. He is coming from Borussia Dortmund, where he'd been the backup the last 2 years. So you're bringing him over here after being a backup, and then you're going to put him, you know, just hanging out for another 9 months. It's like,
oh,
he was so far removed from playing.
I gotcha. Loan him out for those 9 months rather than come hang out in City 2.
Right.
Exactly. And then if you look at like City 2, none of those big guys were playing all that much either. They'd pop up with a game every now and then, but it was still, they were letting a lot of the kids play, which you're going to see, you know, the benefit of that approach as this season moves on, because you're going to see lots of guys having to play over summer, because there's going to be injuries at some point. I mean, it just happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially with like back to your point about the playing style and obviously the heat and everything coming up as well. So
yeah, for the totally game makes press, sense. Right,
yep, exactly.
Yeah. OJ, do you have a last question here for Danny?
Yeah. So do you know this Samir? I think it's Samir Pedro's Selmir Pedro. Do you know anything about him, Danny?
Yeah, he was our number one. He's the first guy we signed. We haven't really seen much of him yet, but he's going to be he's one of the wingbacks.
That's what I was going to ask. I was going to say, why hasn't he played? I don't think he's played at all yet, actually. Or if he did, if he's played, he only got a few minutes in the Minnesota game. But
I mean, the only times I've seen him is when he's been celebrating goals or after the field with the team.
Yeah,
he's
I read about him, and everything made him sound like he was like really good and stuff. So I was like, okay, cool. But
yeah, and he was one of the guys who had played in. You know, the big thing about him in the beginning was I think he's 23. He's Bosnian. He's played in Champions League, so he brings over some really big experience and has already done things that, you know. You read that stuff off to some of the players in that locker room, like some of the kids from the States, and they're just like, oh my God, really? Like it's someone that they'll look up to. But yeah, I'm curious. Another guy that I'm surprised hasn't gotten more playing time, except for when you look at the way the midfield has kind of come together so far. I mean, I guess he hasn't really been needed as much, but the guy that we brought over right before the season started from South Africa, that Blum, he's a really good like box to box midfielder that will relentlessly run and cover lots of ground. And so maybe he just, part of it is he's not quite fit in with the team all that well yet. Or I don't mean fit in like he's not, like he's working against them, but it's just
right.
Maybe he's still picking up some of the intricacies of the way they want to create chaos with some sort of organization. But he's going to be towards the end of the year, you're going to see him doing something special with this team and playing a big role in that midfield.
Yeah. I mean, he was, I could tell you, he was on his national team for, I think he missed like at least a couple games with that. And then I did see I saw him play in the Minnesota game. So he did get I think it was a full start there. So.
Yeah. And that Thomas Ostrak is another one that they brought over that he's dangerous. He's a really, really good, like set piece guy. And he's going to kick in with some goals here in a little bit, but I think they had such a good thing going earlier that it's just why you can't mess with it when things are working right away. But it's a long season. You're going to need these guys. And I mean, we've already seen it with some of our defense guys that are playing on the team. Didn't even start the season with the team. And by the time the season ends, we might have a handful of guys that have already come and gone that did well, but moved to another team for more playing time. It just kind of happens.
I guess.
That brings me here to like final question for you, Danny, but it brings me to it because you kind of already talked about it here. Do you think this team is deep enough to actually make a run for the cup this year? And like, do you think what's your expectations of us being able to make obviously like the playoff tournament and be able to maybe make an MLS Cup run?
Oh man, now you're putting me on the spot of having to be the naysayer. This team will make the playoffs. They will. They've expanded playoffs, and when you look at who would have been the 9 seed. Last year, because there's going to be 9 from each conference that will get out. Last year in the West, it was the Vancouver Whitecaps at 43 points, would have been the 9th seed, and in the East, Charlotte at 42. We already have 15. So we still have a lot of games to go through, and they're at a point where, I mean, they really only have to win a couple more games, too. To make it really, really safe.
Yeah, I was going to say it's going to be interesting the next couple of games for sure, since obviously we're our schedule's about
Seattle.
To get tougher for sure. Yep. Seattle, Cincinnati, etc. Yeah, so it's going to get a little harder for us for sure, potentially. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how they play.
Well, and the Seattle game's going to be interesting because St. Louis wants to play against teams that want the ball. They want to just sit. St. Louis wants to try to create havoc. If the team doesn't want the ball and isn't trying to work the ball around, St. Louis can't create havoc. That's what Minnesota did well against them was I think it was OJ mentioned that they just kind of sat back and, you know, took the easy way out of, you know, but that played against St. Louis. St. Louis wasn't able to be effective because Minnesota said, we'll let you run around. We're fine with, no, we're not going to push. We don't need the ball. And then the best thing Minnesota did that we weren't seeing in some of the other games was Minnesota wasn't afraid to go straight from defense up to one of their wingers trying to push forward. Yep. By skipping the midfield altogether, that meant that any sort of like the pressing and like pressing and organized or as a team that St. Louis was doing, you can't press the entire side of the field at once. You have to present like press in zones, and by skipping over full lines of your team, you're making it so that press is much less effective. And that's what they're going to have to develop another strategy moving forward as the season picks up, is teams are going to start to realize, all right, we'll let them run around, but we're not going to let them strip the ball from our back line. If we're going to lose the ball, we're going to make sure it's further up the field. And that's where St. Louis has been having all of the gifts given to them, because they are creating so much chaos on the back line for opposing teams. And I mean, Klaus has gotten 2 or 3 breakaways out of it. And
Stroud got one.
Oh, I still don't know what happened with that one.
Yeah, he looked at him. I swear. Like,
yeah,
that was the funniest thing.
And you feel bad because that was a St. Louis kid that gave it away. But I mean,
yeah,
it's hard to feel too bad.
He was helping us. He was helping his city.
Yeah. He was totally helping us out in that game. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's the first MLS match I ever watched. And me and my girlfriend's brother are sitting there like, why is this guy not ready to go in? Why are we sitting here waiting so long for him to warm up?
And of course the first goal for St. Louis FC is a self goal. It's an own goal. And I'm like, wow, this is awesome. This is crazy.
Yeah, the thing that I was most disappointed with was Stroud didn't celebrate. Because Packers got a thing where if you score against your old team, you don't celebrate out of respect. Stroud had like two goals for him in like a handful of games. That's not enough to say I'm not gonna celebrate. Endear yourself to your new town. Especially when you consider it. There were little kids flipping him the bird as he was walking off the field. Like the respect didn't go both ways. Just have a good time with it.
Sure. Maybe he felt bad for him also.
His best friends that gave him the ball. So I do. I've heard there's been some rumblings that he was calling for the ball, which you're not. That's what he was doing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, man. Yeah.
Oh, is that dirty? Is that a good dirty?
That's pretty bad. And actually, I mean, it's gonna be hard for any referee to enforce it, but like they can give cards for that stuff for unsportsmanship or unsportsmanlike behavior and all that. But yeah, you're not gonna. That's a hard one to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're gonna give a yellow card to this guy because the other team's an idiot for listening to him. You know?
Come on.
It's like you fell for it, man.
Some schoolyard BS right there. But Danny, thank you so much here for coming on to the really podcast. We really appreciate you having on, and your insight's been extremely helpful. For me, there's a lot of stuff I learned.
Absolutely.
And I feel like I'm decent at, knowing some soccer. So I really appreciate you coming on, as I know OJ and Adam really appreciate as well. And definitely the listener too, because I'm 100%. Sure they learned a lot. Yeah.
Learned
we'll definitely
so
try to
tonight.
Have you back on again. Sure.
Yeah.
Danny, yeah. That great, number 10 question was a lot more educational than I even anticipated. So,
well, it was great. Thank you for having me on, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. We'll try to have you on at some other point, but everyone, that was Danny. We appreciate him being on the show. And it's always good when we have some insight from some people that have actually played at some really high level and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So yeah, for sure.
That was good. Good segment for sure.
All right, guys. So let's transition here and let's talk about some Cardinals. So I guess they're obviously sitting at 2-4. So I guess let's just have a general conversation real quick. What the hell is going on with the Redbirds here? What's going wrong with it? OG, I'll start with you here. What's Adam, actually? Yeah, go for it.
Well, I was going to say, so there has been a lot of good, but also a lot of bad for me, the first six games we played, our offense has been incredible. We've scored 29 runs, recorded 69 hits. I just did the math, and I think that's the most hits actually in the National League.
Wow.
And we obviously scored a series win against, the Blue Jays. So, and then overall, our offense has been certainly pretty hot. However, our pitching has been some of the worst for sure that we've seen in a while. We've got, we've seen some battles and whatnot during opening day with Michaelis. He allowed 10 hits and 5 runs and like 3 innings. Flaherty, for example, he wiggled out of some jams most every inning or whatever. However, he still allowed like 7 walks. It's everything. So, I think in game 3, Montgomery, he went 5 innings. He surrendered 3 hits or 3 runs on 6 hits. Woodford, he went through like 4 innings. He allowed 6 runs on 7 hits, 3 home runs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just overall, our starting rotation is ranking 28th in baseball right now with a 7.14 ERA. So I think that's our problem right now, is that, and let's face it, you know, no one at the beginning of the season believed that our rotation was going to be, you know, the absolute worst. We knew that we had some problems, but we didn't think it was going to be this bad. You know, we didn't expect it to be this bad for very long. But for me, it just highlights, you know, some of the concerns, you know, and what the experts at hand have been saying about us going into the season, you know, and also what about Waino too? Obviously, whenever he comes back, how is he going to be? So that's my take.
And I think, Adam, you know, it's funny that you bring in like the pitching and stuff, because obviously I feel like I got a lot of the stats written down that you've talked about as well. But, you know, one of the things, there's actually several of them that stick out to me. But out of the six outings that we've had from our starting pitching, we've only had 29 innings. That's averaging 4.2 innings pitched per outing. That's really crap. That's not that's not a quality start, and that's just on average. We've given up 42 hits, you know, as you said. We've given up 6 home runs, 15 walks, 29 strikeouts. And the batting average against our starting lineup right now is .300 with a whip of 1.86. That's incredibly high, 1.86. You're pretty much letting on 2 base runners every single inning. That is not sustainable.
Not sustainable at all.
OJ, what's your take on, you know, what we have going on? Obviously, we've talked quite a bit about the pitching here. I mean, do you kind of agree, or is there some other stuff that you think?
Let me say this. So if this basically all this comes down to is a bad 3-game stretch, because I mean, you win against Toronto, and then you get walloped by the Braves. If this happened in the middle of the season, when we already had a bunch of games under our belts and we were like comfortably leading the division, people would be like, oh, well, this happens every once in a while. But since this is all we have to look at, people are like, oh my God, the pitching is terrible. I knew we should have gotten a starter, but like one starter wouldn't have fixed, you know, any of this anyway.
Right.
But to give a little bit of hope, I suppose, as far as the pitching goes, I'm not going to say the pitching is good, but it's not nearly as bad as the results were in the Braves series. For instance, There's two factors that make me think that. And one is that Steven Matz and Jake Woodford both had I guess you'd say unsustainably high home run to fly ball ratios. 40% of Steven Matz's fly balls have been home runs so far this year.
Wow.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Jake Woodford's right behind him at 37.5. So like, you know, that's going to go way down. So that the Braves got some good results for what they did. Although I guess Matz pitched against Toronto, but no, he pitched the Braves game. But so there's that. But then you also have to look at Miles Michaelis and Steven Matz both have BABIPs against of 530. Like, that's also not going to stay up there the entire year either. So, you know, yes, the Braves swept us and it looked bad, but they also had a lot of – they played well and they had a lot of luck on their side, or at least some good luck on their side, because I also saw for the last game, our expected batting average was like 300-something and theirs was 230, but they still won 5-2. So like, that's just baseball, you know, that's how it goes sometimes. Yeah. So it's one of those things where it really sucks, because like I said, that's all you've got to look at, but it ain't
for sure
that bad.
still early for sure, but obviously
right, context is not a good start.
I mean, they had Adam Wainwright on the radio show. This is before the game against the Braves on Wednesday, and he was saying that, you know, it's something happened with when Tony La Russa was there. People were losing their minds over the first few games, and he's like, "Guys, it's the first week of the season. You think Albert Pujols isn't going to start hitting?" You know, it's right. One of those things. Just be patient, back off the ledge, try and enjoy a little baseball. Hopefully, they turn it around.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I think it's not even a panic button. But you start getting more upset. Like, so say like we go to the Brewers and we get swept. all of a sudden it's like, wow, now that's your major divisional rival that is out competing you right now. So now you got to really start looking internally, even though it's in the first three season or series, right? But yeah,
that's a lot more concerning to me as well. All right, that would be a lot more concerning to me as well, just because they're not the quality of the Braves or the Blue Jays either, you know?
Exactly.
Those are also two very good baseball teams.
Especially Toronto is an incredibly high offense like team. You know what I mean? They have a lot of high powered offense there. So I think that, you know, again, context is very important. Obviously, the Braves are one of the favorites to potentially get back to the World Series this year. So especially one of the favorites to win the East, even over the really expensive Mets. So I think that you're right. Yep. There's a lot of context that needs to be taken here. It's funny how, again, as you said, you know, it's your first week and, you know, we haven't seen much. So we start panicking a little bit more. Let me ask you, go ahead, OJ.
Oh, I was just saying, well, we've been hyped up. That's part of the problem is we've been hyped up for this team for all off season, like all these awesome stud prospects and everything. And then they come out, they beat the Blue Jays in the series, and then they just get walloped by Atlanta. Yeah. And you're like, oh, and they were frustrating games to watch too. It felt like every time Atlanta was batting, their half of the inning lasted like a fucking hour. And then when the Cardinals come up, they just hit three ground outs and go back to the bench. Yep. It's like, no, it's hard to watch.
For sure. And let me ask you, because I want to talk about the Bro Neal thing with Marmol here, because if anybody did not see it, essentially O'Neal, which is one of the faster players, not even just on the St. Louis Cardinals, but in Major League Baseball. He's a very fast player. It's the reason why he's our center fielder typically. He was on second base. A ball is hit out into right field for, you know, just a base hit. Typically, this will score a runner from second base, especially a guy with O'Neal's speed. He rounds third, but when you watch the video of it, he's very slow rounding third base and gets thrown out by a very good strong throw by Acuna, but by like 10 feet, right? And Marmol said, you know, that it was terrible hustle, did not like that whatsoever. O'Neal came back out and said, hey, you know, that's a disagreement. I'm out here, you know, hustling my butt off every single game. So, you know, I don't agree with that at all. And then O'Neal actually got benched the next game. So, OJ, I'll start with you here. You know, do you think that Marmol's in the right on it? Do you think that, you know, that was the correct response? Like, what's your kind of thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, it's better to handle that stuff privately in any walk of life. You know, because if you really are trying, if your intentions are truly to fix a problem, then you go to somebody privately first and you have words with them, and that way they don't feel like you're putting them on blast. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
And that's not to say it's never appropriate to go to the media with this kind of thing. So, but like, I honestly don't have enough information to make a call on that. I don't know what's happened during spring training or earlier in this year, or if there's extenuating circumstances that would make Marmol take this action. If it's just this one instance, then yeah, I don't think he did the right thing. But I don't know that for sure.
Right. You know, Adam, what about you? What's your thoughts on that?
I agree with OJ on that. You know, we don't really want another Tony La Russa in that sense, that, you know, where he's had some public spats, obviously, with some of our players. And, you know, it's turned ugly. While I do agree, you know, looking at it, and, you know, I think that O'Neal should have had a little more, you know, pep in his step, per se. Part of the reason why I feel like there was some frustration there is because, you know, let's face it, that with that out and whatnot, that basically killed a lot of our momentum there as well. You know, we were on a rally there for a little bit, and then that just really killed it. And so, and then we ended up losing, I think, 4-1. So I think that there were some added factors to that as well, where there was this frustration. And I think that the emotion of it seemed to get to Marmol a bit. And he probably shouldn't have said what he did, in my opinion, especially so publicly.
In the media, especially, yeah.
Yeah. If you want to get frustrated, you know, like, take it out man to man, per se, but don't air that shit out in public. You know, I don't really think that that's appropriate. And then, you know, they could disagree, whatever, but then, you know, put it behind you, and then, you know, you know what I mean? But the fact is that it kind of got ugly there, and it's not a good look for sure.
Yeah, for sure. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, how they come back. And I would hope that Marmol comes back out, you know, obviously, you know, O'Neal starts or whatever. And I would hope that he would single him out in a positive manner the next game, especially if O'Neal comes out and performs well and just be like, hey, you know, he, you know what? You know, I kind of said some stuff to him. He completely turned it around. And I love it. And he's now showing the effort that I know he has. And I said what I said, that, you know, boost him up, whatever those words are. But I think that, again, that's definitely, I think, what's needed here for sure.
It certainly doesn't look good, especially since we're already having some trade talks about him as well. And for, you know, obviously for some, you know, possibly him, for, you know, for some, you know, rotation in our pitching per se. It certainly doesn't play well, but yeah, we'll see.
And OJ, you talked about some of the hype when it kind of came to some of the newer players and stuff like that. So I want to talk to you guys specifically about Walker and Contreras. I'm just going to blow through some real quick stats here and then just kind of get your, you know, general feel on it. So Walker so far in the year is batting .333. He's got two doubles, one homer, five RBIs. He's struck out three times. He's got a stolen base, on base percentage of .360 and slugging .542. Contreras is also batting .333. He's got one double, one RBI, one strikeout. On base of .333 and a slugging .389. So Adam, I'll start with you here. I mean, what's your takes on Walker so far? What's your take on Contreras so far? I mean, obviously so far, Contreras missed a game for the injury.
Yeah, for sure. But Walker with, you know, with a .902 OPS so far, I am super excited that he did show up. You know, they gave him an opportunity and he did show up for sure. I'm really excited to see, you know, Walker, you know, play, and I'm so glad that he is part of this team. Yeah, I was a little nervous coming in because obviously towards the end of spring training, he was starting to, you know, kind of slump a little bit, but I think overall, what we've seen has been outstanding for Walker. Contreras, obviously a little scary there, you know, in the first game, you know, with the knee injury, but thankfully everything came back clear. He was able to come back. Since then, you know, he's been at the plate 18 times. With that, he's had six hits, three runs, and an RBI overall. Like you mentioned, I think his average was .333, an OPS of .722. He's doing better than I thought he was. I'm not going to lie. I was really concerned about Contreras coming in. Didn't think he was going to be that much of an offensive catcher for sure. But he's doing a little bit better for sure than I thought. So we'll see if he keeps it up.
OJ, what's your thoughts on the two?
Yeah, so I'm actually very impressed with both of them, at least offensively, I should say. Jordan Walker, just to give a little perspective, you know, so I've been kind of trying to watch the games as much as I can. We've had a lot of day games recently, so, you know, I keep an eye on it while I'm at work, but I might not see everything. What's weird is my initial impression of Jordan Walker was that some of his hits were a little lucky, and, you know, it took a while for him to get, you know, like that first double he hit is where I was like, okay, he stroked that and he with a good launch angle, hit it hard, you know, like that's what we want to see. But the numbers, you know, they say he's even better than that. Well, I was thinking, I mean, is it, they give him an expected WOBA of .359. His actual WOBA is .389. That's your on base plus slugging, but weighted to value on base more. And it's on the scale of like an on base percentage. So if like .320, .315 is like league average. So in other words, he's hitting incredibly well and he's a 21-year-old rookie.
That's awesome.
I'm very happy with that. He definitely looks rough in the outfield though. It takes him some time to get to some balls. And I think he's cost us some runs because of that. Which is kind of why I was, you know, maybe thinking about having to start the year in Memphis, but he is tearing the cover off the ball, so I can't really complain. I mean, he's probably making up for any gaps he has in the outfield with his hitting at this point. So, you know, happy with him. And and he should continue to get better in the outfield. He's not like Burleson. He's not like a slow guy. Like, he's fast enough out there. It, as he gets more comfortable with the position, he'll get better and he'll stop making so many mistakes.
For sure. And the one thing that I have to say, Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to go on with Contreras, if you
don't mind. Yeah, you should. Yeah, my bad.
So, Contreras, his results so far, well above 317, which is probably around league average, which is really good for a catcher, like, especially. But his expected wOBA is 403. So, wow. Basically, he's been getting very unlucky even with his results. So, he's tearing it up at the plate. There's probably not really much point in delving into defensive metrics yet. There hasn't been very much time this season to do that.
Yeah.
Those usually take a lot longer to normalize, but I haven't noticed him do anything wrong, and he's probably better than Kisner behind the plate. So
certainly. I agree with that 100%. Yes.
Yeah.
100%. I was so glad that he was able to come back, you know, make a quick recovery. So
yeah, I was worried we'd be like 2 weeks with Andrew.
I did too, for sure. I was like, oh God, this is gonna suck. Yep.
Might as well write a K right there. Well, yeah, and for me, like, you know, my side of things, I mean, I'm very happy with Walker hitting. Again, as you said, OJ, it seems a little rough in the outfield. I wouldn't be surprised if they started kind of like relegating some of his outfield time, not all of it because he needs it to develop, but kind of see him in some DH roles where he's still hitting the ball and then feeling good about himself in there, but also take the pressure off of being an everyday right fielder too. So, you know, and Contreras to me has kind of been average. I don't even know, like, I'm not blown away by him, but I'm also not super disappointed. You know, as you said, like, it's really
average for a catcher is good.
Yeah,
exactly.
He's doing better than I thought he was going to do. Honest to God, he really is.
Yeah, yeah, and once we start seeing like some defensive metrics and stuff like that, it's going to make it even look better. You know what I mean? So, I think that's going to be two obviously real key interesting people to look at because they were some of the biggest changes that we've had in the lineup. So
for sure.
Well, the guy you guys didn't ask. Well, you didn't ask about Josh Nolan Gorman. He's killing it.
Yes,
and that's why Jordan Walker's not going to see a lot of DH time anytime soon because you want to get him and Brendan Donovan in the lineup as much as possible. But Nolan Gorman has a ridiculous, ridiculous 584 wOBA right now with an expected wOBA of 542. Wow. So not even getting very lucky. He's just killing it right now. Now, I assume at some point the pitchers will readjust to him again and these numbers will come down, obviously, but he's so hot right now, you can't take him out of the lineup.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, yeah,
not.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I think it was the home opener where he had didn't he have how many home runs?
Had a two homer game. I think it was in like
maybe
the second.
Maybe it was the second. Maybe it was the second, third game. That's what it was.
Oh, like it was the second game. It was.
Yeah, it was the second game. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
He had two home runs and four RBIs, I think, in that game. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we were at a sample size of six games. So, you know. It's a little easier to run those 540, you know, weighted on base averages, but
yeah, we'll, you know, obviously see how, you know, the season progresses and we'll definitely be able to look a little bit further on, you know, as the season progresses, and we get a little bit more sample size, but
for sure.
Yeah. So let's go Cards.
Let's go Cards. Let's go Battlehawks.
Go Blues, I guess.
Let's go Blues.
Anyway, yeah.
I was going to say, Vladdy's back in town, but, you know,
yeah,
good to see him, but sad as well. And ish. It is. And whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is what
well,
it is.
Adam, let's talk about some of the socials here. What is the media question of the week?
Media question of the week. We're going to be asking our fans, who is your most beloved coach or manager in St. Louis sports history? Let us know.
That is a difficult one, yeah. Because that you got Dick Vermeil,
yes.
Obviously, like you know Tony
La Russa.
Lot
to pick from.
A lot of history, yeah. That's a good one. A
lot of history there for sure. So we'd like to hear from you. Let us know on Facebook.com/TheHometownLosers. Which again, that's LOUSERS. And you can check us out on Twitter.com/TheHometownLosers. We'd love to hear from you guys. So please, you know, give us a like. Give us a tweet and let us know, you know, we'd love to be able to feature your answers next week on session 20.
Absolutely. OJ, what about you? What's your game of the week? What got you excited coming up?
Honestly, guys, right now I'm all about the soccer. I don't know if it's just because it's new or what, but and maybe it's because they only have a game every week, so every one of them's important. Right. But their game this Saturday at 9:30 Central against the Seattle Sounders, powerhouse Seattle Sounders. I'm looking forward to that a lot because, you know, kind of like as was mentioned in the conversation we just had with Danny, they play a different style for Minnesota. I mean, most people would certainly consider them, I think right now, a better team than Minnesota, but Minnesota kind of plays a style that works well against us. Whereas Seattle, you know, they actually play soccer. They actually try and go out and score some goals. They try and make things happen themselves. So I'm looking forward to see if St. Louis can take advantage of their aggressiveness, you know, maybe get a sneak a win out of this one. I mean, if they beat Seattle, no one can really say they're not a good team.
Yeah, and I was just about to say, this is the true, real first true test for STLSC. Is this success actually just lucky, you know, that no one knows how to play them? Or are they really that good? So that's a very good game to have for the game of the week, for sure.
Well, thank you. Like, I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, guys, as always, I really enjoy talking to you guys here. Always look forward to the podcast and always look forward to hearing from the listeners as well. So, but until next week here, we will see you on the Hometown Losers podcast. Have a great night, guys.
Hey, this is Josh. Thanks for checking out and tuning in to the Hometown Losers podcast. Check us out next week as we continue our silliness and talk a little bit about the St. Louis sports scene. Catch you next week.